Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Hi there, and welcome to the Explaining History podcast. And today I'm going to look about fascism in Britain in the immediate aftermath of the Second World War and how the fascist leader, Oswald Mosley, tried to continue with a variant of the extreme right-wing politics that he had tried to build in Britain in the 1930s with the British Union of Fascists. The thing about fascism in the 1930s is it increasingly came to be seen as a foreign and an alien creed, an entirely un-British notion. The Second World War cements that, and it made anti-fascism a key part of Britishness. And it reinforced central aspects of that. Dunkirk, the Blitz, and the Battle of Britain all coalesced to create a battling underdog identity in Britain, and the notion that fascism, Nazism, was the creed of the bully and the thug. And the outcome of the war, the discovery of the crimes of the Nazis, helped to vindicate, really, the war itself and the struggle against fascism, even though that was quite a murky affair on Britain's part in a number of key regards. The idea of Britain standing alone, even though Britain didn't stand alone, with it had an entire empire behind it, and the selective memory of the war that really was, in British eyes, in the 50s, a British victory. There's a really interesting part of Tony Judd's recollections in his book of essays, Thinking of the 20th Century, with Timothy Snyder, where he said that young boys in the 1950s, when he was growing up, their war, the war they heard about, was the war of bombing Germany and being with Monty in the desert. And so the idea that fascism was an integral part of British politics or culture or national life was really quite alien after the war, and probably during the 1930s. If you read Richard Overy's Morbid Age, he makes the point that fascism, the struggle against fascism, was seen by many British people and many commentators as really a struggle of civilization against barbarism. So the thing that Roger Eatwell points out in his brilliant book Fascism, A History, was that while Britain was never occupied, there were myths of anti-fascist resistance, just as these had existed in France and Italy after the war. He writes, "The Second World War strengthened British self-images of decency and tolerance. It also laid down an agenda of social reform, for propaganda had told the British people that they were fighting not simply to defeat the Nazis, but to create a new Britain. Remarkably little was made of Nazi atrocities, even in the closing stages of the war. These were major factors in the landslide victory of the Labour Party in the general election which followed shortly after the victory in Europe. Although Winston Churchill had been considered a great wartime leader, British suspicion of demagogic worship leadership counted against him in 1945, and the Conservatives went down to a surprise electoral defeat. 6 years of Labour government followed, marked by full employment and a historic programme of social reform." He goes on to discuss the fate of the post-war fate of Oswald Mosley and his wife, Lady Diana Mosley, formerly Lady Diana Mitford. The fact that the leader of the interwar British Union of Fascists, Sir Oswald Mosley, planned a comeback in such a hostile climate reveals much about the man. So it would be reasonable to have imagined that Mosley would have disappeared into the back pages of history, would have realised that globally the cause he had struggled for had been absolutely destroyed. And that's not what happened. There were plenty of people in the European Fascist International in the late 1940s, early 1950s, who, whilst there was almost no chance of any kind of political resurrection for them, still believed that there was some kind of future for their ideas. When Mosley, who had been released from internment in 1943, after the war, was convinced that fascist ideology would still have a role to play in the future, particularly in Britain's reduced circumstances. Government restrictions meant that he had to wait till the end of the war before he could take any steps to relaunch his career. He went into publishing initially and organised a book club to keep contact with his old supporters. So the first stage of things for Mosley was about reconnecting with people who had once supported him, many of whom who had abandoned him, many of whom who had realised the game was up for fascism. In 1947, he became certain that some kind of new fascist order would be possible. You have to bear in mind, factor into all Mosley's thinking, that the British Union of Fascists had in no way been as successful as any of the European fascist parties anyway. But 1947 is an important year. 1947 is the year of the great of the beginnings of Labour austerity after the war. It is the year in which the pound becomes fully convertible, and there is a run on the pound and an economic slump, the likes of which Britain hadn't seen since the early 1930s. There was a shortage of foreign currency, which saw bread rationed. Bread hadn't even been rationed during the war. There was a banning of imports of supposed luxury foods like tinned fruit to prevent any outflows of capital from the country. And this meant that, as far as Mosley was concerned, the Labour Party, of which he had been a member in the late 1920s, was in terminal crisis, and that a Labour government would fail to really create the post-war world that Britain wanted to see. Mosley believed that this crisis had only been avoided by the war anyway. I mean, he's wrong in thinking that, because much of the crisis was created by the new tranche of war debts. But he thought that only rearmament and war had managed to stave off Britain's economic problems. In 1947, that he thought that a further economic crisis was on the way. And so he created in 1948 an organisation called the Union Movement, which was the rump, really, of the British Union of Fascists. There were 8,000 or so members who were concentrated mainly in former areas of British Union of Fascist control, such as the East End of London, where economic deprivation, poverty, and a kind of a Victorian anti-Semitism, which had been partly the product of resentments fostered against Jews who'd come from Poland and Russia in the late 19th century, emerged. During the emergency in Palestine, the 1945-48 guerrilla war that Zionist guerrilla fighters fought against the British, there was an upsurge in anti-Semitism in certain parts of Britain, particularly the East End of London. But even in this movement, in this climate, the Union movement wasn't really able to capitalise on anti-Semitism and to attract new members. Moseley was seen by other anti-Semites in Britain who were keeping a low profile as being a liability, as being yesterday's man, as being a failure in a way. He was a very difficult man to get along with, even in extreme right-wing circles. The same sorts of political skills of cooperation and negotiation have to be present in order for organisations to coalesce. He was a loner, a bitter, resentful man, and he came out of internment with a sense of his own kind of messianic status, his own persecution complex, and believing, as so many in these circumstances do, that he was suffering for some greater purpose. His supporters were loyal to him, kind of yes men, but unable to force Moseley to consider what he did. His most close henchman, Geoffrey Ham, who was a Welsh schoolmaster, had been one of the kind of the key street activists for the British Union of Fascists, and had fought street battles with Jewish and socialist anti-fascist protesters during the 1930s. And he was one of the people who would emerge to try to kind of revive fascism in the post-war era. However, the difficulty was this. The street politics of the Union movement made it impossible for Moseley to kind of reinvent himself, which was one of his key goals, to try to slightly distance himself from the British Union of Fascists and to present himself as a more moderate, respectable character, which is something that the various fascist movements try to do periodically, with normally with limited degrees of success. In the 50s, Ham moved to Ireland, and he abandoned politics briefly to try to write a cultural journal, and attracted kind of fascist fellow travellers such as Ezra Pound. But its links to Moseleyite politics meant that it was unlikely to be taken seriously or embraced by anybody from sort of Britain's intellectual classes. Moseley, of course, was trapped by his own ideology.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
And fascist ideology is very much an activist ideology of action speaking louder, words of struggle, combat, battle, fighting, and constantly advancing this sort of manic dynamism which devours the idea from within. He perceived the growing importance of the media in his political campaigning, but was able to access less and less of it as TV cameras in the 1950s particularly were not really looking to record what he was saying, and radio before that. After 1945, his only hope was to try to remain as a figure who existed above the day-to-day cut and thrust of politics and present himself as a public intellectual, as Roger Eatwell puts it, as a philosopher king. He was a very widely read man, very educated, and in 1945, after 1945, his writings constitute a significant part of fascist thinking in the English language. Of course, Mosley wasn't an original thinker. Many of his ideas can be retraced back to Gabriel D'Annunzio, can be traced back to French fascists, and much of it is kind of clumsily ill thought out. Now, much fascism is clumsy and ill thought out. There are obviously very few fascist programmes that are kind of refined in any sort of logic, and the vast majority of them are sort of clumsy, ham-fisted attempts to make sense of an increasingly complex world by retreating into the past. So the fact that Mosley, in the kind of the grand scheme of things, is seen as kind of one of the weaker fascist thinkers really tells you something about the man. In 1946, he wrote a book called My Answer, and this was a way of trying to defend the BUF and to look at the story of the British Union of Fascists and try to rewrite it. And it was also to present Mosley, this is another key part of kind of fascist discourse, to present Mosley as a victim of internment, presenting him as somebody who had suffered terribly during the war, and that he had been a true patriot. He noted that those who had admired the Soviet Union were not considered traitors, but weakened the force of his argument by presenting the recently departed fascist leaders, Hitler and Mussolini, as being kind of entirely benign figures. That if Hitler, he said, had resigned or been killed in 1939 or 1940, he would have been remembered as a great leader. Mosley was able to, or attempted to, defend fascism, and his defence was more than just an attempt to justify his pre-war policies. It reflected a fundamental philosophical continuity in his post-war thought. In particular, there was a strong emphasis on leadership and will. These were key aspects of all European fascisms, and the idea that society, particularly post-war materialist capitalist society, would continue to degrade, and there would be a search for some kind of movement which could speak to men's souls, men's psyches, beyond that of the material or simply the Marxist collective. He argued that fascism between the wars had been too much on the side of nationalism. It's hard to imagine a nationalistic fascism, one that doesn't rely on nationalist narratives to kind of sustain itself. He said that national economies, particularly European national economies, were too small in a world dominated by two superpowers, and a greater Europe was necessary. He was like, there were a number of probably very unworkable schemes, and you can read about these in Martin Thomas's brilliant book Fight or Flight, about the possibility of creating an Anglo-French imperium in Africa and the Middle East that would retain much of what had been gained by Europe in the 19th century. And this would be a part of a kind of some sort of European system. Europeanism as a notion, a kind of a fascistic, racially purified Europe, had been a key part of much fascist thought. The Nazis believed when they were invading Russia that they were doing it's not just on Germany but on all of Christian Europe's part. It's some sort of notion of an anti-communist, anti-Slavic, anti-Jewish crusade. Europe is a third force in world politics. However, during the period of the Cold War, was entirely unworkable. Mosley hoped that other European fascists would embrace this and would manage to find some way of building a Europe that was neither Soviet nor American. However, there was almost no chance of this happening when two rival superpowers divided the continent between them. And he held, there was a summit on the Third Force Europe held in Venice in 1962. Mosley saw full integration of European nations, not just a federal superstate, but a vision that would be so great that it would almost be overwhelming for other fascist groups to embrace. The thing is, these sorts of things are largely unattractive to various national fascisms because their whole ideological expression is one based in national identity, not transnational or supranational identity. Mosley's views, and here I quote from Roger Ewell, Mosley's views differed notably from those of most activists in the union movement. These were men who were nothing if not rabid nationalists, who knew that WOGs started at Dover. Mosley tried to get round this problem by operating a dual strategy. He courted the mantle of the responsible thinker, while his lower-level activists pandered to the lowest common denominator of street racism. But in such a leader-oriented movement, it was difficult to separate the leader from popular concerns, and Mosley, always the activist, was magnetically drawn back to the crowd. So during the 1950s, by the late 50s anyway, Mosley thought that he had found the issue that would bring him back to centre stage, and that was, of course, non-white immigration into Britain. In 1945, Britain was almost exclusively an ethnically white country, if you ignore places like Cardiff, Bristol and Liverpool. And of course, the massive, massive desire for labour and few immigration controls saw a huge surge of immigration. After 1947, this becomes dramatically increased. By 1955, there are 20,000 immigrants coming into Britain each year, mainly from the West Indies. And by the 1960s, this had risen to almost 60,000. And this was based on a fantasy that they had been told, one of British tolerance, fair play, and acceptance. British middle-class and working-class communities were almost exclusively either indifferent to or hostile to the new immigration. A poll in 1948 found that of white British people found a widespread belief that coloured, in inverted comma, people were characterised by headhunting, black magic, polygamy, and enormous sexual appetites. These views didn't automatically translate into organised political action against immigrants, but during 1954 to 55, leaders of the Conservative government considered making opposition to significant further immigration a major plank in their next general election programme. So Mosley wasn't able to penetrate the world of high politics ever again, but he was able to push the issue of race. After the 1958 race riots in London's Notting Hill, Mosley stood for Parliament. He stood for Parliament in the 1959 general election, and the campaign was based on what Itwell refers to as the high and low road, the split between Mosley's supposedly more acceptable face and the street violence and intimidation and bullying of the union movement. The high road talked of coloured repatriation, even offering loans to the receiving countries for economic development and long-term contracts to buy their produce. The low road wandered through the swamps of black crime, sexual innuendo, and claims that immigrants lived on pet food. Mosley's eldest son, Nicholas, strongly rebuked his father over this, later noting that the right hand dealt with great ideas, but the left let rats out of the sewer. Despite whatever racial attitudes there were in Britain in 1959, Mosley gained only 8.1% of the vote. He lost his electoral deposit for the first time in his career. He still believed immigration was going to transform British politics, and to some extent it did, except he was not going to be the person to ride racial division back to power. In the early 60s, Mosley's union movement slumped to about 5,000 members, and in the 1966 general election, Mosley stood again, meeting with even less success than he did in 1959. Anyway, I hope you found that useful, and I'll catch you on the next Explaining History podcast. Thanks very much for listening. All the best. Bye-bye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.